Fabulous. It's great to be here with the Calling, our new podcast, and delighted to have Andrew, you in the driver's seat, kind of helping to command and control this. And
a little bit the passenger seat, I think.
All right, whatever. We're in the same car, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a great opportunity for us just to meet with really interesting people, talk about what's going on, and also share a little bit about what's going on here at Christ Church, which is such an interesting place.
Yeah, it seems like everything's been going on for the last week. I drive by, and you've got tents going, and you had the big fall outing, and the Cuba weekend and everything.
Yeah, we had the great fall gathering a week ago today. Big crowd, lots of fun, lots of children and young parents and everyone, and wonderful food and all. And then on Friday night, we had Noche Cubana, where we had 140 people come out. It was sold out. We had live Cuban music, dancing, rumba, salsa, all that good stuff, and pig roast, and people wearing really colorful tropical clothing. And, in 33 years of ordained life, I can't remember a church event that was more fun.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And so did you get your break out your rumba?
Yes. There's a fairly new parishioner named Sophia who was out on the dance floor with me, and she is a massage therapist, actually.
Okay, this is getting even more interesting.
Yeah, and that woman can dance. And after 5 minutes, I was exhausted. I thought I might need a respirator. That's never happened to me while dancing, but she does these really short, choppy steps, and perfect for the Cuban music, but it was really beyond my scope.
Yeah, people who can dance, it's sort of like people who can play tennis really well. Like, they make you feel like you can dance too for a short second, and then you.
Now you're making me feel bad because you always beat me in tennis. So, like, you know, she was beating me in dancing, and anyway, it's good for me to be vulnerable and show people I can't do any of these things very well. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, speaking of Cuba, we have our first guest, I guess our second guest, if you count our last week with the Navy SEAL. But do you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, so Mark Pendleton is with us. He used to be the dean of the cathedral in Hartford, which is the cathedral for the Episcopal Church of Connecticut. And now he is the rector of Christ Church in Exeter, New Hampshire. He drove down about 4 hours to be with us this weekend to join us along with his beautiful bride, Leslie, for Noche Cubana, and then to preach and teach today. Mark's been visiting Cuba since 1986, where he spent a year there while he was a seminarian. He has been back there about 25 times. There are over 1 million Episcopalians in our country and in 18 other countries around the world, and there are very few people who know Cuba better than Mark Pendleton. So we're thrilled to have you here, Mark.
Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
So, Mark, let's begin with a really probing question. What is your favorite Cuban dance?
Dance. Well, I can dance, I have to say, but I do not cha-cha-cha. I can salsa, but my go-to is the merengue because you can just turn around in circles and pull that off a lot easier. But I definitely did a lot of dancing over the years in Cuba.
It's great, fueled by mojitos and Cuba Libres, I'm sure.
Yes, without question.
And have you had a chance to hear the Buena Vista Social Club perform live?
You know, I think there are different versions of them around Havana in different clubs, so one never knows what it takes to be an official Buena Vista Social Club offering, but you can definitely hear some good music down in Havana, and that has been really the soundtrack for some people's love of Cuban music now for a number of years. So
it's kind of like knockoff bands on the Beatles that I did hear the so-called Buena Vista Social Club perform live, and it's just there are many more variations.
Exactly,
of it.
Yeah.
What is it about Cuba that produces some of the world's most incredible music?
Well, I was told that they, for one, invented the conga drum. And it was an infusion, really, of the African music heritage that was a product of slavery. Cuban received many, many slaves from Africa, and they brought forth the rhythm, the conga drum, and it just melded with the Spanish influence to be a hotbed of music. And maybe it reached its glory days of what we remember from the 40s and 50s when there were all those incredible nightclubs and casinos down in Havana where the likes of Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and Carmen Miranda would be present. So it's amazing history.
What it would have been like to be in Cuba then is something else. Well, speaking about African influence, could you tell us a little bit about Santeria, the Cuban religion, which is kind of like a fusion of of African religion, Christianity, and a little voodoo inserted in there.
Yeah, because really Cuba had so many slaves who were transported to Cuba, especially in the middle part where I spent most of my time in Matanzas. They brought religion really from the Yoruba people in present-day Nigeria, and it is still going strong. There are so many different variations in Latin America. Brazil has a form, Haiti has a form, but it is really authentic to their gods and goddesses back from Africa, and they still practice it. You will see people to this day dressed in white. You know they are a santero, and I have deep respect of that faith. We actually, one of our last trips, our youth group and I, we wandered into a house that was in full Yoruba dance mode, and it was an experience that my young people will never, ever forget, and we had to pull them out of there. But it was amazing.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, how Cuba's famous for sort of having the cars that were from the 50s or whatever, that because they didn't have any cars, and so they take care of them. But I was thinking about the church and about the Episcopal Church and how it kind of went underground probably for about 30, you know, from, so it's 61 or something to 91 or something. So I was wondering, did any of that, did it kind of mutate a little bit? Like, have there been parts of kind of Yoruba, or like there's some interesting things that have kind of crept into, you know, Episcopalian practice, you know, as it during those 30 years, or is it sort of feel like a service here?
You know, I think it really had to do with the clergy who were involved. I was mentored by a priest named Juan Ramon de la Paz, who had deep connections with Santeria and another form called Espiritismo. And he respected their expression of faith, and so they respected him. And I think really dependent on the clergy around. But it still takes, you know, we're mainline Episcopalians down there, and so some love to sing just from out of the old hymnal. It really, the service didn't look much different mm-hmm. than services here. It really would depend priest to priest, though.
Yeah, Mark, when I was on my first trip in Cuba, our youngest daughter, Isabel, and I went to visit this church in a former sugar plantation town. And the church was started by a former slave for former slaves, an extraordinarily poor church. Wonderful people, though. And I remember learning that when the people went back to their homes, they often practiced these Santeria rituals at home, but they were like together Episcopalians when they came to church. And then when we had a driver who took us on a tour of Havana in the outskirts, he took us to a park, and we watched where the Santero was doing this Santeria ritual with a man, and he had two chickens, and he would dip them in the river and kind of shake them up and down this man's body while two women would ring these tiny little bells. And, you know, to be honest, I wanted to bring that ritual back here. I thought, you know, baptisms, you know, live chickens, and we immerse them in the water, and we shake them all over the people's bodies. And I thought it would add a little color and stuff. Unfortunately, the chickens died in the process. But I thought, wow, this is really a different kind of religion.
It is. And I think to this day, where I have seen the growth over the church over the last few decades, we are also, Episcopalians are taking a hint from more evangelical Pentecostal churches, and so the rhythm of our music is more upbeat. We have people clapping and singing praise music. I think that is for young people today. Our companion church in Cardenas has a electric guitar, a drum kit, singers, and so the young people are trying to sort of liven things up a little bit as well, to make sure that they are just not Cubans' version of the frozen chosen Episcopalians of our history there. So it's a pretty lively time, and our folks so wish they could come back and have that experience in New Hampshire, but it's not the same. It's not the same.
That's right. Rock on, Exeter.
Exactly.
So what made Cuba such a focus for you, Mark?
Well, I really didn't have much of a choice. I was in my early 20s. I had recently come back from Colombia, South America, where at the age of 20, I found Christ and felt called to be ordained. It took me a while to find a church, but after I graduated from college, I said, send me to seminary. My bishop of Florida said, you're too young, but we have this beginning of a relationship with Cuba. Would you be willing to go there? It took me about a year to get a visa because I was really the first American since the revolution to go there for that long on a religious visa. They didn't know what to make of me, and so I had to wait and wait and wait. But after I did, and I was 24, it was an incredible experience, and Cuba got in my blood, so and it's still there.
Did both countries assume you were a spy, basically?
I think they did. I know I was being watched, even though I felt I had a lot of freedom around the country. But I do wonder what my file is like there with our government anyway, and their government. So, it was an amazing year.
Did anyone from the Cuban government ever talk to you or try to, you know, approach you or turn you? Or
no, but, you know.
I mean, this is 1986, so this is, you know, Sting had just written Russians. This was the height of the Cold War, right?
Yeah, and you know, I never knew who of my friends really wanted to be a friend with me, or were they invited by the government to just tag along with me. But I thought I had amazing access to people. I drove the dean of the cathedral around in his Russian-built Lada car. And things were, I would say, a bit more innocent in Cuba back then. The prostitution wasn't a thing, and that came later after the special period and things started collapsing. There were just freer times where we would go to, you know, as young people, out to some of those nightclubs you hear about where the cigarette girl with the box of cigarettes came along literally down the aisle and said cigars, cigarettes, just like out of a movie. It was quite amazing.
Wow. I was worshiping with a group that I brought down in Cienfuegos, and the priest was speaking to us, you know, from the front of the church, and he said to everyone, smile for the camera. You know, and it was just that he was making a joke, but he was reminding us, in Cuba, you are always being watched.
Right. And talking about Fidel Castro over the years, there are sort of hand signals where when people wanted to mention Castro, they wouldn't name his name, but use their hand to make a gesture of pointing to their beard, even if they did not have a beard. So a man or a woman would make a gesture that I'm making that you cannot see.
He's rubbing his chin.
Yeah, and I have a beard.
With a certain amount of gravitas.
Exactly. So that was the way to say you're talking now about the person who shall not be named.
Oh. And so some of the women down there have beards, I take it.
No, I want that corrected for the record. They would do it as if they did.
And so were you there also for, you know, the special period you talked about? That was 91, right, when Russia collapsed?
That happened right afterwards, but I know a great deal about it because we helped refugees leave Cuba, a good friend of mine, another friend of mine. They left right after that as things were collapsing. And I mentioned this morning already that my son followed my footsteps 30 years later, spent a year in Cuba, and married a Cuban girl. Mm-hmm. And she grew up in the special period, so we learn a lot about it by talking to Nile. And she grew up in poverty, and it's a way you can tell because at a family meal, she's done with the food in a minute. Mm-hmm. And you cannot unlearn hunger, and we've learned a great deal from her experience.
It's like you get a dog who spent any time in a pound or whatever, and they eat their food right away.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So just for so folks know, the special period is when Russia's economy collapsed and they had to pull out of supporting and propping up Cuba and their economy and stop buying sugar. So the Cuban economy just plummeted.
It was not only the Soviet Union, but all the Eastern Bloc countries as well faded away. So Cuba had a lot of contacts with East Germany and Romania and Bulgaria, you know, Czechoslovakia, all of those countries. It all went in a heartbeat, and they had an amazing contraction of their economy. And it is, as you know, looking back to the special period, I don't know what they're going to call the period now that they are facing, but it seems to have a lot of echoes of that special period.
I was thinking that, right? Because now Russia is in a sort of difficult spot, and they're, you know, you might have another, you know, I think Putin was actually supporting Cuba, you know, pretty well during the 2000s and, you know, the knots, but now that might turn around. So,
yeah, yeah, let's talk about that, because last time I was there, Dick Schultz and I, one of our parishioners and leader of our Cuban mission, stayed in a Casa Particular in someone's home, and I noticed there's this, you know, handsome portrait of a guy in a military uniform downstairs. So we're up on the terrace having breakfast one morning, and I said to the owner, who's the nice gentleman in the uniform down there? He said, you know, in Spanish, that was me. And I said, interesting. And we started to talk about the military and the Soviet Union, and things just really went down from there. He said, do you know how many American military bases are around the world? And, you know, he was talking about how we're trying to influence the whole world. And he had gone off to be trained in the Soviet Union. So there's just such deep ties between Russia. If you try to buy books in Cuba, the only books I could find were either in Spanish, which I was happy to buy, or Russian. So what is your sense of the ties then and the ties today with Russia, especially with all that's going on with Ukraine, et cetera?
Well, what I've seen and what I've read is Russia still has a geographical interest in Cuba to have a beachhead 90 miles from their still enemy is an amazing thing. But even probably more so than Russia is Venezuela, with the leftward tilt of Venezuela beginning with Hugo Chavez. They are as important as Russia because of the oil that Venezuela sends to Cuba and the Cuban security force that surrounds President Maduro at this time. They have that symbiotic relationship. And if Venezuelan government, if that had collapsed a few years ago, as many thought it might, it would have been very difficult for Cuba. And so they are sort of stuck with these two declining governments there. And their fate is tied to both Russia and Venezuela. I would not want to be in their shoes.
Right. Last time I was there, they had a Russian destroyer right in the harbor, and then they were still exporting Cuban doctors in exchange for oil from Venezuela. So they would send doctors, get barrels of oil in return.
Yeah, I was reading an article about Bishop Griselda, is that right?
Yes.
Who I'm probably pronouncing that terribly. But that she actually, I guess there's some protests right now because obviously things are really tough right now in Cuba. But I thought it was interesting that the church was kind of openly supporting the protesters, or she did. And I thought, well, is that something that is religion sort of political down there a little bit?
Well, I don't know. I would imagine that she is using her words very carefully, as many church leaders do down there. What I saw, there were great protests in last summer down there because people, it was at the end of COVID, they were just fed up. There was no food, and people went out on the streets in the town our companion parish is located. Many of them were peaceful, but like any kind of unrest like that, it became, there were a couple who started looting stores and becoming a bit more violent, and so that breakaway group unsettled many. And so what I think the Cuban leaders are just openly saying more is that something has to change, and that the people are really feeling oppression, and this is not a life that is a dignified life. So they are taking more risks than they ever did. But the punishment for that crackdown last summer was brutal, as is in the case of many grasping dictatorships around the world. It takes courage to go into the streets, because they are not seen right now. They got sentenced for many years in prison.
So, Mark, how is Cuba different today than it was in 1986 when you were first there? And how is it different than when the Castros were overseeing things with this new regime?
Well, I think it was really the result of what I heard, and the Soviet Union put sort of in comparison to the Marshall Plan post-World War II in Europe, they put as much money in many ways as we put into Europe to rebuild. They were just floating so much that the early years of the Cuban Revolution, they built up their medical system, their education system. Many people saw themselves lifted out of poverty. But then it got stuck and it stayed there. And that grand experiment then faltered some years later. But for me, it was a time where you would still, young people would go out into the countryside on school projects. They would cut sugarcane. They would pick tobacco. And even some of my friends who are not pro-government whatsoever sort of hearken, I don't want to say romantically, but they thought that was an incredible experience of their youthful formation to be a part of something like that. And all of that is gone because there's no money to support any of those collectives out in the countryside. They are literally decaying. But today's reality is so much different from that. But
there's a huge gig economy, isn't there? Everyone's got a little job.
Well, it said that a Cuban can MacGyver anything. They can fix anything. They know tech. We bring down a lot of old cell phones. And one of the big things that happened with the outreach of the Obama administration is there were telecommunication companies that helped get them established, connectivity, Facebook, and all the rest, that now really gave rise to that unrest. And so they planted those seeds that may come to fruition later on.
Yeah, I got the sense like 3 or 4 years ago, my nephew went to Cuba. Everybody was like, hey, Cuba's open. We're all going. And then, of course, COVID happened. And like, is it becoming a tourist? Are there a lot of Americans there, or is there kind of a pullback now?
Well, there was. So you went from one administration to the next with differing opposite views of Cuba. And so whatever door was open was quickly closed under the Trump administration, uh-huh. because it has been really the politics for a long time. There are many Miami Cubans and New Jersey Cubans who do not want many Americans going down to Cuba because they believe that that is just holding up the government down there. So they just really do not like to see much tourism. But there are those of us who would like to see Americans see what has happened over the last 60 years. And we don't take kindly for being told where we can't travel. We like to go where we want to go.
Well, you certainly do, right?
I like to go.
Now, the Obama administration opened it up because they really felt like 50 years of the blockade had just not changed anything. What is your take on that? Has the blockade been effective in some ways? And then in terms of,
Well, you know, for many years, from the early years, I mean, Eisenhower was the first president to put in some aspects of the embargo. Just reminds us how long this has been into effect. It certainly makes economic life more challenging. But I think after a while, my view has been it's been counterproductive because the revolution blames the embargo. Today, with less success because the people know more and know better. But they really blame the embargo for many of their woes when it's really their own mismanagement and the corruption that has led to so much devastation in the economy. But I was of the view that if given the opportunity of more travel, that there might be a change. But many people leave, and then we had the Havana syndrome, as some of the listeners may have heard about, where people were becoming sick at the embassy and elsewhere, it's happening around the world in China and elsewhere, but they had to name it the Havana syndrome.
Yeah.
And
do you have
that
a pet theory?
Oh, there's so much conspiracy and suspicion there.
Andrew and I love conspiracy.
Absolutely.
Just dish.
You know, one thinking is that there was, like many regimes, a small group who would not have benefited from an opening with the Americans, that they really feared their own future. And so maybe they allowed some technology from an outside power. Everyone loves to point the fingers at Russia. But then there are some scientists. It's a real baffling thing. They really can't conclusively say what happened there. And even though it's happened in China and elsewhere, it's such a strange thing.
Let's switch to religion for a minute. I want to ask, what makes it different to be a Christian in Cuba compared to other Latin American countries?
I think it's just the freedom of expression. They spent most of the last 60 years living under a government that their constitution declared there was no God. And so for many of the population, they were indoctrinated into a Marxist system. The church did not have the freedom that they used to have schools, to educate, to give another version of what the government was saying in the lives of the people. And then even being the church today, you have to get government permission to build a church, to buy materials, to fix a roof on a church. And they are not as discriminated against as they were, but still, there's still a holdover, the sense of you're not going to go far if you are a person of faith in Cuba. So they faced obstacles that someone in Honduras or Brazil would not face.
And I was noticing that, like, there's about 10,000 or so Episcopalians now, or maybe in Cuba. And, you know, it's a country of 11 million people. And obviously, I think Catholicism has a big hold there as well. So, like, what kind of people are Episcopalians in Cuba? Like who is being attracted to that church, and where do they come from?
Yeah, it's interesting, because in the heyday of the Episcopal Church in Cuba was really probably from, like, 1920 through the late 1950s, where many American missionaries followed the business folk who came down there and worked and exported sugar, and they built many schools. They were a church of the middle class. And the Roman Catholic Church in Cuba, in my reading, really never fully got outside of the cities. And so they didn't have the heart of the people the way they do in Mexico or Brazil, or especially in Colombia. So there was ample opportunity for non-Catholic, you know, Protestant churches to sort of flood that zone and be faithful. But today they are like they are today. They are people who like the Catholic kind of ritual and liturgy, but just are not in favor of some of the doctrine. And over the time, the Episcopal Church is livening up their worship, so we're not just so staid, and might we even say a little boring. And so we're bringing in some great music.
Yeah, and you were a part of the group that made them now part of the Cuba diocese.
Right. We worked through a lot of canonical and governance things, and we helped reach out to many bishops and friends of the church to raise upwards of $1 million to seed their pension fund, and now we are a part of. I have a 501c3, the Friends of the Episcopal Church in Cuba, that will be present and working in the future as we ride the roller coaster of the church in Cuba with many joys and a lot of disappointments.
So there are about, as Andrew said, 10,000 Episcopalians down in Cuba, 21 clergy roughly, and 65 congregations, many of which meet in houses. What would you like to see, and what do you think Bishop Griselda would like to see for the future of the Episcopal Church in Cuba?
Well, when we talk in our churches here, and if we would ever talk about maintenance, that has a negative. It's a pejorative. To just maintain is not mission. And then I think about Cuba. Just trying to hang on literally to church buildings so the government does not take them away. Hang on to dignity. Hang on to just the one day in the week where they can proclaim Christ and as I like to say, love wins, and they can just be their true self, is a hard thing to measure. I don't know what the metric on that is, but this is a very faithful church living through a perilous moment, doing all they can to just maintain their faith in dignity and hope. They are beaten down, but they are not without hope. And for me, that is the inspiration.
And you've mentioned that there are some, obviously positive things that people who come down on mission trips and can do. But what are some of the dangers? What are some of the perils of, what folks coming from the outside can do? How do we need to think this through carefully?
Well, when we have worked with, and there's a team of the Friends of Cuba who have worked with the bishop, we've come up with a business plan. And part of the reason we did that was we were hoping that things would open up and we would get funding from NGOs and help rebuild the church in Cuba. So we certainly have some know-how we can bring, greater transparencies when they receive some funding, but more so, like anything, to just go be open and learn from them. And as I say, park the type A personality on the border and be ready for whatever comes, and that's a great lesson.
Do you want to talk a little bit about The Calling? So the name of our show is The Calling, and one of the reasons we thought we'd talk about that is because we're interested in sort of what makes people do what they do and why and how they find meaning in it. And like, so how did you get drawn to God, and how did you get drawn to this?
Well, I was 20 years old. I took a year off of college to find my path in career, and got sent to Colombia, South America, and got immersed in what would later be called liberation theology, lived with a very poor family in Bogota, and on a random trip with some European backpackers in Ecuador, a fellow backpacker handed me a dog-eared book called Cry of the People that documented the lives and the deaths of martyrs in Latin America, and I opened that book, read that book, and met Jesus on a beach. And from that moment on, I received Christ and felt a call to be ordained. And for me, that is a foundational story for me, because over these years of ordained ministry, where the church can have its joys and struggles, I said, I knew Jesus before I knew the church. And that has helped me over the years.
Well, I'm sorry if I can just... One of the things I actually have always wondered, right? So I bring it back to tennis. I was playing with a tennis pro, and I said, you know, did you watch the U.S. Open? And he's like, no, the last thing I would want to do is watch the U.S. Open, because mm-hmm. I play tennis all day and I teach tennis all day. And I was wondering, for somebody who everybody, I think, has a relationship with whatever they believe in, but then you do, to do it professionally, does that change your relationship with that, with faith when you started... You know, once you started actually helping others find their faith, does that change your own relationship?
Well, what that experience has meant for me over the years is that I'm probably most filled with joy when I'm with people. I remember times in Cuba, for example, where we would spend 4 hours on a train to take communion to two old church members. And when we went there, we got in our vestments, we sang all of the hymns, we lit the candles, and we were there present, and that church stayed open over the years and has now been rebuilt. And being with the people for me is a joy. And so if I don't get back to Latin America once every few years, I sort of forget why it is I got in this racket, sometimes I call it that, the joys of ordained and in the institutional church. But it's that experience, it's the love of people and why people have so been inspired to give their lives to God.
So how do you stay faithful to that, in that long calling in the same direction? So many, you know, I've known a lot of lawyers who've kind of burned out after like 25, 30 years, and some other people in different professions who just find it a little monotonous. How do you stay faithful to both your priestly calling and also this sense of staying with the church in Cuba?
One thing I do now as a Spanish speaker in New Hampshire, where there are not many of us, is that I take a day out of my parish work and I go to the county jail that houses ICE detainees from all over New England and Massachusetts, especially, and I do intakes working with the ACLU, and I sit and listen to stories of people working through the asylum process, listening to their heartache as they came across the border and are facing tremendous obstacles. And it just reminds me of the fact that we are born in many different parts of the world. We are blessed, and we have the burden of trying to live out our life the best way we can. But again, it reminds me of those early roots of my faith. And I go back to the office. I don't want to say inspired, that's not the word, but I know why we are doing this work. It's for those special moments with people.
Let me just two last questions. I just want to ask you, if you weren't doing this, what else would you be doing?
If I hadn't gone into this work, I hate to say this, but I probably would be a lawyer at this point. I sort of apologize for that.
Why is that? Are you just, you're good with arguments? You're good with,
I don't know. I think I was maybe heading towards this track, but I wanted to go into the Foreign Service. I had studied Russian and French and was horrible at both of them in university. And so I said, let me learn an easier language. And that is why I picked Spanish. But I really definitely took a different route. I thought first I was called to be a Roman Catholic priest, and I knew I would be a horrible celibate priest, and then literally walked across the street and found the Episcopal campus ministry, and my life has never been the same.
Wow. So final question, what gives you your greatest sense of calling and your deepest joy?
Right now, it is being with people. It is sharing this this journey with my family, my wife, Leslie, my two children, Will and Nile, were bilingual at a very early age. We have been all in to this thing we call the church, and especially with this life in Cuba. And it has blessed us and challenged us. And we're just, anytime we can share the good word, we do so. So that's a great joy.
There's one last thing I guess we should say. Is there anything that people can do to help support your mission or Cuba?
Well, I would say the good people here at Christ Church in Greenwich have opportunities to build this relationship with a place that is away from the Havana in Holguín, and just stay connected through what may be a very difficult future.
Yes, and we have lots of chances right now. If people would like to donate to the Cuban mission, we're going to be bringing down medical supplies. We're not asking for people to donate those supplies, but to donate money so that we can purchase those supplies in bulk. Many people are donating expired medicines and things like that. That's not going to be very helpful. And we're also going to purchase a water filtration system to bring down with us. Bishop Griselda's vision is to have a water filtration system in every church, and that is used by the entire community. And the people down there have hard water, which ruins their teeth and affects their bodies in terrible ways. So when we install one fresh water filtration system or put a new one in to one that's no longer functioning at the optimal level, we transform the health care for an entire community. So you can give now, and it will make a lot of difference.
That's great. Well, thanks. Is there anything else you want to say that's coming up at Christ Church that people should be aware of who are listening to this and have listened all the way through the podcast?
I know the Reverend Dr. Cheryl McFadden has an incredible women's retreat coming up in November. Terry Ellsbury's got a great Bible study launched on Wednesday mornings at 10 o'clock for great figures of the Old Testament. And in the evening, he's doing one from 7:30 to 8:30 for men on the Gospel of Mark, Hope for the Future. So we look forward to having folks participate in all these and many other great things taking place at Christ Church.
Amazing. Mark, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.